This is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Abortion was legal across the United States for 49 years from the Roe v. Wade decision at the Supreme Court until the Dobbs v. Women's Health Center ruling. Those 49 years are not the entirety of the battle over reproductive health care for women in the United States. Far from it. Plenty happened before that period and plenty during it as people worked for and sometimes against each other seeking rights for women. Our guest assembles the story in a recent book. Felicia Kornbluh is the author of A Woman's Life is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. Felicia Kornbluh is a professor of history and affiliated faculty member in gender, sexuality, and women's studies, and in Jewish studies at the University of Vermont. She's the author of two previous books on poverty and welfare reform. Felicia, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the first part of the subtitle, My Mother. You only found out as your mother's life ended that she, Beatrice Kornbluh Braun, was a central figure in legalizing abortion in New York. What did she do?
My mother wrote the first draft of the law that decriminalized abortion in New York. In New York, like every other state, by the late 19th century, abortion was a crime. And even though we think of New York as a very liberal state, advocates and activists there didn't think they were ever going to win. And this final push for legalization of abortion was one that was started by my mom and her allies in the National Organization for Women. And they won an enormous victory 2 years before Roe versus Wade made it to the United States Supreme Court.
And yet you didn't know this. It's almost like your mother left you a final assignment of a sort.
Yeah. I mean, my father used to say that the law that legalized abortion was written in our living room. But that was the only thing I ever heard. And it really wasn't until my mother died, and even more my mother's memorial service, when the legislator, the member of the state assembly that my mother had successfully lobbied to support this bill, stood up and he said, yeah, she was the one who talked me into being a leader in this fight. And she was the one who literally wrote up the legislation that became the legislation that was introduced originally in 1969 to completely remove abortion from the state legal code. And that became sort of the gold standard in the whole country.
So the story clearly focuses on the actions that happened in New York State, and that brings us to the neighbor of the subtitle. This is My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. Who is the neighbor of the subtitle?
Our neighbor, also very sadly, someone who passed away, who I didn't get to interview, but I have read her papers. So our neighbor was a Puerto Rican doctor named Dr. Helen Rodriguez Trias, and she was a central figure in the movement against what was called sterilization abuse in the 1970s. And from that movement for sterilization abuse, she became a reproductive rights and reproductive justice champion in the United States and all over the world. So I use the stories of my mom and Dr. Rodriguez Trias to look at what happened to them and what happened to the movements that they were directly involved in and what happened in New York, but then also to look at what happened in the whole country. And in the case of Rodriguez Trias in particular, even what happened on the global stage.
The details are really fascinating, and the surprises really come fast and furious in the book. Why was the organization of Dr. Helen Rodriguez Trias at odds with the likes of NOW, National Organization for Women, and Planned Parenthood?
Well, I think this is such an important story for us to study today when we think about our politics and some of the differences of race and class that separate us. So Rodriguez Trias knew, because she was Puerto Rican and because she was part of the Puerto Rican movement, as well as the women's movement, she knew that sterilization abuse was happening for Latinas in the United States and for Black women in the South and Native American or Indigenous women on reservation and many low-income white people as well. So she knew that was happening. My mom and the more middle-class women in the National Organization for Women, mostly a white organization, they didn't know it was happening. And actually, for them, it was sort of the opposite problem. Even if people wanted to have a sterilization procedure because they decided they didn't want to have any more children, they mostly were not allowed to. So they saw the world just from a different perspective, and they even had a different understanding of what they meant when they used the phrase reproductive rights. And so it was very hard for them to work together. And what you see in my story is that now initially is even opposed to new guidelines that would have helped working class women and women of color avoid this kind of abuse. And they were worried that it would be a block in the way of people's reproductive rights if they put some of these controls in place. And instead, the women of color were saying, no, we need this because we're being pressured by our doctors and our social workers and other people to have sterilizations that we don't really want to have. So it's kind of a perfect example, you know, of how race and class can mess up our politics.
So was there a fair amount of sorting out as you've looked further into the story of are you with us or against us in women's health?
There was. And when, for example, the Committee to End Sterilization Abuse, when they win their big victories, a lot of the classic feminist and reproductive rights organizations are on the other side. So their biggest thing that they win is at the national level. They get the Carter administration in the 70s to put in new guidelines for sterilization all over the country. And those guidelines still exist. But at that time, Planned Parenthood and NARAL and the National Organization for Women are all opposed to what they're doing. And I'm not sure that we've ever really sorted that out and that those movements have ever really sat down and talked about what happened in the 70s and 80s and really talked about how to get past that.
Felicia Kornbluh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is A Woman's Life is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. So you mentioned you didn't get a chance to visit with Helen Rodriguez Trias and that your mother and she were on opposite sides at times. Did they ever work together?
They were cordial, like neighbors. They were neighbors, but they never did work together. They were part of some of the same efforts, though, and in particular, this effort to change the law in New York State was one that encompassed everybody who identified as a feminist at that period. And so I think that Rodriguez Trias and my mom were both pushing for the same thing. And Rodriguez Trias was organizing on behalf of this bill that my mother had played a hand in writing. But they would have been part of different subgroups of the movement at that time, right? They would have been pushing for the same thing, but maybe in different ways and in different feminist organizations. And that's, you know, that's the way social change gets made sometimes.
And why was it important to you to tell this story at this moment in history?
Well, even before the Dobbs decision came down from the Supreme Court, I knew, and I think many of us knew, that something big was happening in the reproductive rights arena, and it wasn't good for those of us who care about keeping abortion legal in particular. And so when I found out about my mother's role, you know, I first of all wanted to honor her, and I wanted to honor the memory of this remarkable woman who lived next door to us. But beyond that, I also wanted to make a contribution to today's politics and to say, first of all, that it's possible to win. Right? When these people really put their shoulder to the wheel and they threw everything they had at these efforts they were involved in for reproductive rights, they won in a remarkably short space of time. And I think we all need to remember that today.
Well, the approach now seems to be a bit scattered. I mean, you point out some of the successes in the book, or at least some of the successes that have been going on electorally, like Ohio enshrining abortion rights in the state constitution. But you do see some problems, apparently, in taking a state-by-state approach to abortion rights.
I do. I would never want to diminish the work that people are doing, right? I think there has been incredible creativity and dedication. And people have really mobilized resources, you know, the resources of people's time and money to an extraordinary degree. My concern is that it's really not sustainable. And so what I see from the history is that in the 1960s and early 1970s, there were all these state level campaigns and city level campaigns going on all over the place. But we really needed Roe versus Wade. We really needed a national solution as well. And the fact that it came from the Supreme Court and it was a constitutional solution, that was very, very valuable. So today we don't have a friendly Supreme Court, of course, but I think it's still possible to think about for example, the Women's Health Protection Act, which is a congressional bill that has been kicking around already for a decade. And when the Democrats have controlled the Senate or the House, that bill has passed the chamber that was controlled by the Democrats. So what I'm looking forward to is, after November, maybe we'll have an opportunity if there's good leadership, you know, progressive Republicans or Democrats, maybe we could have a Women's Health Protection Act, and maybe it could be signed by the president, and that would change the game. People wouldn't have to work so hard. They wouldn't have to spend all these resources. You know, we could work on something else. We could actually have positive improvement instead of just fighting for something that, you know, that we had for 50 years and then lost.
Felicia Kornbluh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is A Woman's Life is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. Let's get into some of the details of what the book covers. What was the general nature of New York's abortion law in the 60s, and how did activists chip away at it?
It was very, very restrictive. And interestingly, they didn't really chip away. Like, they tried to pass reforms of that law to make it slightly more liberal, and those reforms kept failing. So the only thing they were able to do was to pass a very dramatic transformation of the law, which was this law that my mother drafted. And they weren't able to pass it in exactly the form that she wrote it. The form that she wrote it was basically just remove abortion from the state legal code and let people do what they want. In consultation with their doctors and their clergy and their family members, right? So that they didn't pass. They had to negotiate down a little bit from there. But basically, that was it. They just completely rewrote the law, and they were able to pass it in the spring of 1970, and that became a launching point for Roe versus Wade itself.
You mentioned the conversations about, you know, this is something between a woman and her doctor, a woman and doctor and clergy, and people do still say it's a matter for a woman and her doctor, but I think it's expressed more as a team now. I mean, back then, I mean, like around 1970 in New York, how much more power did the doctor have than the woman?
Well, that's a good point. Doctors did have a lot of power, and the only exception in the law was that there was something called a therapeutic exception. And the idea was that if you met certain quote-unquote therapeutic guidelines, that then you could have a legal and safe abortion procedure. So that did happen. And over time, doctors came to include people's mental health as part of that therapeutic exception. But the problem was that it was doctors who were in the way and who were making the decision for people. It was still very, very restrictive. Very few people got through this therapeutic guideline or the therapeutic boards that were established within hospitals. And, you know, it was very undignified. You know, it's not a way to treat people like they're full citizens or primary citizens of our country to say, well, if you want a medical procedure, you have to go before this board of experts who don't know anything about your life, really. And then they're the ones who are going to get to decide. So that was the thing they really wanted to overcome. And that was what my mom's bill did, is it took a new approach, you know, without doctors standing in between people and the healthcare decisions they wanted to make.
Well, did she want more? You mentioned she did have to back off a little bit to get the bill she did get. Were there things she wanted to do more than that that didn't get into the bill?
Yeah, and it's very much like the conversation we have about Roe versus Wade, right? What they wanted was that people would be able to make those decisions throughout the entirety of a pregnancy, right? And we know, we've seen some of these examples in Texas and other places, you know, that something can go wrong, even very late in a pregnancy, where somebody might, you know, feel or their doctor might tell them that they really need to have an abortion. So in New York, that was disallowed, right? They started out saying at any point in a pregnancy, and then they negotiated down to 24 weeks, which is just about the two trimester point, which was enshrined in Roe versus Wade. So Roe versus Wade also said in the first two trimesters of a pregnancy, roughly, you know, 20 to 24 weeks, that in that period, people should be allowed to pretty much make their own choices. But then in the last trimester, in the last several weeks of a pregnancy, then, you know, there might be other considerations. So that was the negotiation, and that was, I guess, kind of the mainstream opinion in the 60s and 70s. And I think we've seen it with some of these recent cases, we've seen the weakness of that kind of accommodation.
We'll pick up the conversation with Felicia Kornbluh about the book A Woman's Life is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange in just a bit. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR. I'm Jeffrey Riley, and we are talking about reproductive care, both in the past tense, but also in the context of the present tense. Our guest is Felicia Kornbluh, who is a professor of history and a faculty member in gender, sexuality, and women's studies and Jewish studies at the University of Vermont. She discovered some interesting things about her mother very late in her mother's life, and that was one of the things that led to her book, A Woman's Life is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. So after your mother was able to get this bill through the New York legislature to legalize abortion up to a point in 1970, it had a very big attractive effect on New York, it sounds like.
It did. So people came from every part of the country, and they even came from abroad, internationally, to New York, because suddenly the state of New York had the most liberal abortion law in the Western world, right? It might have been equally easy to get an abortion in some of the socialist countries, the Eastern Bloc. But outside of that, this was pretty much the gold standard. And I think that also had a huge impact on the politics. The Supreme Court and activists in other states, they were all looking to New York, and they saw that it was possible to have this kind of a liberal law. You know, the society didn't fall apart. It was possible to deliver this kind of health care safely in large numbers, even to all these non-residents of the state. And I think that had a huge impact in terms of changing the conversation, changing popular opinion, changing medical opinion, and ultimately even changing the views of the United States Supreme Court.
Ah, that was my next question. How influential you think New York's law and the apparent success of it in the early days had on the Supreme Court coming down with Roe versus Wade? What, 2 years after the law went into effect?
Yeah, it was about 2.5 years later. The Supreme Court ruled in Roe in January of 1973. So, yeah, I think it had an enormous difference, and some of it was direct and some of it was indirect. So I think there was this kind of demonstration effect, like if some of the justices in the Supreme Court believed that abortion was unsafe, well, here was an example of how, you know, many, many procedures were being performed, and they had good data, they had good research, and they were overwhelmingly safe. But it was also that the activists who were responsible for the New York law, including my mom, they worked very hard to change the opinion of key decision makers. So, for example, the American Medical Association was very important, and they tried to get the American Medical Association to support the New York law effort, legal change effort. They were not successful at that, but shortly after New York changed its law, the American Medical Association changed its policy on abortion, in part because there's so many doctors in New York, and they didn't want the doctors to be, you know, doing something that was legal in New York, performing abortions, which was at that point legal in the state of New York. And yet the canon of ethics of the AMA said that they were never supposed to perform an abortion procedure. So they changed the ethical canons of the AMA to align with the law change that they had in New York. And they also were lobbied aggressively by activists to do this kind of policy change. And what you see is in Roe versus Wade, the AMA decision, the change in the AMA policy is all over the footnotes. And Justice Blackmun, who wrote that majority decision, he really cared about doctors and about medical opinion. And it was really one of the key things that he relied on when he was making his ruling in Roe v. Wade. So yes, that's only one example. There are a million ways in which they actually shaped Roe v. Wade.
Now, we know the story of the overturning of Roe versus Wade, mostly. I mean, it took a long, concerted effort, largely in converting the judiciary. Abortion opponents played a very long game. Now, what about the groups that pushed for abortion rights back then when Roe was first decided? I mean, did most of them stay intact and on the scene?
A lot of people did stop fighting. They thought that they had won. And so, you know, I think people continued to care about this issue and to fund some of the national organizations. But for many people, it became more a matter of checkbook activism, I think. However, there was a group of people who continued to fight, and these are some of the people that I focus on in the later part of the book. They were the ones who saw that Roe versus Wade was just a beginning. It wasn't an end to the story. And one of the things that really alerted them to the problem was, to the continuing problems, was shortly after the Roe v. Wade decision came down, there was a huge crisis and scandal in the United States because two little girls in Birmingham, Alabama, were sterilized without their parents' consent. And this happened when they were under the care of a federal government program under a branch of the Office of Economic Opportunity. So this was very, very terrible. And there were court cases about it, but there also started to be a movement, a grassroots movement in opposition to sterilization abuse. And so some of the people who didn't go home, you know, and didn't stop their activism after Roe v. Wade were the people who started to organize against this kind of sterilization abuse. And they also realized very quickly that they were going to have to fight to keep the funding for abortion in place. And that was very, very quickly under threat. So those two things, the fight against sterilization abuse and the fight for the funding for abortion in the post-Roe v. Wade era, were the big things that kept people marching and demonstrating and letter writing and doing all those things when many former activists kind of put away their marching shoes and decided that the battle was won.
Felicia Kornbluh is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book on this period and this struggle is called A Woman's Life is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. So your neighbor, Dr. Helen Rodriguez-Trias, her organization actually formed after Roe versus Wade. And did she take the existing pro-choice organizations to task for what they left out?
She certainly did. What she saw was that after the issue of sterilization kind of leaped into the headlines, and it became clear that for some people, Roe versus Wade was not enough, right? That it did not actually secure everybody's reproductive rights. Then what Rodriguez-Trias started to do was to try and talk to the feminists who were involved in what was then called the women's health movement and say, look, we still have work to do on reproductive rights, this dimension of the reproductive rights movement. And she had a lot of pushback for that. And it was a kind of embittering and difficult moment, I think, for her and for some of the other activists who were really alerted to the problem of sterilization abuse that came up in the mid-70s. And ultimately what they did was they organized on their own. They created an organization called the Committee to End Sterilization Abuse, or CESA in Spanish, cease or stop. And then later in the 70s, they created a bigger group that was dedicated to the fight against sterilization abuse and to continuing to fight for abortion rights. And that was called CARASA, the Committee for Abortion Rights and Against Sterilization Abuse. And they continued to do battle with some of the more mainstream members of the Democratic Party and the Liberal Alliance and the women's movement itself.
Some of those groups that you just mentioned then were kind of saying out loud, weren't they, that sterilization could help some women?
Yes, there had been in the post-World War II period, there was kind of white liberal consensus and I guess conservative consensus too, about what people called population control. And so So the organization Planned Parenthood, for example, was involved in all these experiments around the world in how to lower population. And, you know, there's a good side of that. Overpopulation did threaten economic well-being in certain ways. But there's also a really bad side about it, which is, you know, what else might be required in order to increase people's well-being? Like, and the other things that might be required to enhance people's well-being weren't really being talked about. And it also wasn't really being discussed that people need the full spectrum of choices. So the people I'm writing about were sort of the American version of the fight against population control. That's the way we could think about it. That even in America, there was also a consensus about quote unquote population control. And there were people who probably thought that they were liberals who walked around saying, you know, this community needs to have fewer children and this family needs to have fewer children. But this other community, this white middle-class suburban community, they need to have more children. It was sort of unconscious in the way that race and class biases are often unconscious. And it created a lot of bad feeling, I think, within, you know, what should have been a strong political coalition.
Did Sesa and Carasa ultimately get the things they were looking for? They did quit the scene decades ago. Is that why?
They got a lot of what they were asking for. I think in the short run, at least, they saw incredible successes first in New York City and then at the national level. What the people I interviewed said was that they wished that the organization had stuck around because there was more that they could have taken on, right? Of the agenda that they set out for themselves, they were successful. But there's so much more to do. I mean, even today, sometimes I hear people who are environmentalists, for example, talking about population control as a way to limit the demands that we're making on the natural world. And, you know, it's a similar thing. Like, yes, but we also need to be really careful about the way that that kind of conversation can get racist and classist. And so I think SAFA could have helped us. It could have been, you know, more of a guide to a lot of issues that were still with us in the 80s and 90s and are still with us today, where we really have to navigate reproductive rights and gender-based rights and also things like race and class and environment. And it can be very tricky.
So, Felicia, what lessons would you say could be learned from back then, either in modeling or in avoidance, to push for the case for abortion rights now in a post-Roe country?
I think the first thing that we learned from both of the movements that I study is that grassroots action is enormously impactful, and it always is. And even when we don't believe it's going to be impactful, even when we can't see it in the short run, it makes a huge difference. And I see that in both of these movements and both of the coalitions they form, you know, within a matter of years, they're able to do things that seemed completely unlikely, even impossible, just a little while before. So I think that's really, really important. And we're seeing that in the post-Dobbs world as well. You know, people are doing things that we never thought they'd be able to do. And then the second thing I would say is that we do need to be careful about the kinds of coalitions we form and the language and the rhetoric we use, the arguments we make. And, you know, I'm white and I'm middle class and I'm on the board of Planned Parenthood in my own state. And, you know, we have to work really hard in that organization and in the movement to make sure that the demands we're making and the arguments we're using to support those demands are not falling into some kind of class bias or a racial bias. And it takes a lot. You know, it takes all the work that organizations started to do after the George Floyd murder. It's all still urgent work, I think. And that's not just because we want to feel good about ourselves. It's because we actually want to make a political agenda that works and one that's going to last.
So something of a history lesson, also something of a template here. Felicia Kornbluh's book is called A Woman's Life is a Human Life, My Mother, Our Neighbor, and the Journey from Reproductive Rights to Reproductive Justice. Felicia is at the University of Vermont. Thank you so much for sharing this with us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for today's Jefferson Exchange. Our website is jeffexchange.org. All of our interviews get archived there and sent to podcast sites. Angela Decker of JPR News is our senior producer. Charlie Zimmerman is our assistant producer. Zach Beagle of Southern Oregon University is our student engineer. Maxwell and Terry Longshore composed our theme music. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.